Unfortunately, it's not very common for women to kill their husbands. That's why when they do, we take notice of it.
A preacher's wife is pushed to breaking point.
Mary got the shotgun to get his attention.
A desperate gold digger plays catch and kill.
I never thought I would know someone that would be able to commit such a heinous crime.
And a scorned ex-wife uses the only power she has left.
Be careful who you try to destroy. Because it might just come back to visit you.
Blushing brides who became lethal wives. These deadly women made a vow in blood. Till death do us part. It's early morning in Selmer, Tennessee.
Right.
Pastor's wife, Mary Winkler, is taking her daughters on a road trip.
She was taking them to the beach.
Okay.
She had always wanted to take them to the beach. The father, Matthew, had always promised to take them to the beach.
Take her girls to the beach to enjoy one last day before their lives as they knew them ended.
When the Winkler family is missing from church that night, elders go to their home to find out why.
Everything looks in place.
Okay,
it's quiet. There doesn't seem to be any reason to be concerned.
Matthew? Mary? Matthew?
Until
Hello?
They walk into the marital bedroom.
Matthew? Matthew?
Drew, quick, come in here!
And there they find the body of their preacher laying dead and cold on the floor.
When Sergeant Roger Rickman attended the murder scene that day, he had no idea of the storm that was brewing.
We really wasn't sure what had happened. Mary was not there, the children were not there. We didn't know that, you know, that they had been abducted or what.
Selmer is about to become the center of a case that will divide the country and shake a devoted congregation to its core.
Oh Lord, you have enticed me, and I was enticed. For whenever I speak, I must cry out.
For
the word of the Lord.
Matthew
me,
Winkler has been pulpit minister at the Fort Street Church of Christ.
Matthew came from a line of preachers, his father and grandfather. That's what he did in life. That was his vocation.
Matthew's career means he is always in the spotlight. And so is his wife, Mary.
If you're a preacher or a preacher's wife or a preacher's child in a small town, you're constantly under a microscope.
But away from the eyes of the congregation, Mary is under even more intense scrutiny.
Dad, look, we got French fries. They're really yummy.
Now that's a healthy meal, isn't it?
He expected more of Mary than anyone should expect of a human being.
Yeah, sure you can.
This was a marriage where the husband was in charge and made all the decisions. He would lose his temper. He would belittle her.
How many times do I have to tell you not to
buy junk food for the kids.
A little treat every now and then, Matthew, it won't hurt them.
But I don't want them to get fat like you.
He was, I believe, very emotionally abusive.
Criminal profiler Candace DeLong believes years of subservience took their toll on Mary's self-esteem.
We know the effects of ongoing verbal abuse from a husband to a wife has a long-term, deleterious effect. It beats the spirit down.
Throw that in the bin.
They begin to believe what the offender is telling them, which is that they're worthless.
Don't talk back to me. That's your ugly coming out in you.
Then one night, Mary receives a mysterious email that seems to offer a chance to prove she's not worthless.
She never could seem to make ends meet. And she saw what she thought was an opportunity. But unfortunately, her solution to financial difficulty was to get involved in what is commonly called a Nigerian scam.
Mary falls prey to an online fraud that sinks the Winklers deep into debt. Her secret plan to prove herself has backfired.
Hey.
And she can't bear to admit her failure to Matthew.
She couldn't find any way to sit down with her husband and say, I screwed up. I'm sorry.
I believe she kind of got in over her head over that, and she didn't want Matthew to find out about it, and I think that's why she done what she done to him.
Dawn on March 22nd, 2006. The last day of Matthew Winkler's life.
That morning, the baby was crying. We knew that Matthew liked to sleep. He kicks her out of the bed, go make the baby shut up. Matthew comes in, pinches the baby's nose, and holds his hand over the baby's mouth.
Matt, stop it! She can't breathe!
Horrified, Mary's protective instinct takes over.
Mary said that he suffocated the baby. That was Mary's choice of words. A momentary squeeze like that, I would not call suffocation. But Mary did. And I think that raised up some internal rage.
Mary is seething. She wants to confront Matthew.
I think she was at her wit's end, and now she wasn't the one being punished. Her children were being punished.
But Mary knows her husband won't listen to her. Unless he's not given a choice.
She said that he always said that a shotgun like the one he had would make a hole this big in you. And that made her think that a shotgun would get his attention.
Get up. Get up, Matthew. I want to talk. I want to talk.
A tranquil morning in Selmer, Tennessee.
I do not think that Matthew Winkler spent 1 minute of one day of his life ever thinking that he had anything to fear from Mary Winkler.
Get up. Get up, Matthew. I want to talk.
Pastor's wife, Mary Winkler, has decided to stand up to her husband after years of abuse. What happens next remains in dispute to this day.
We only know what the physical evidence shows us, and we only know what Mary tells us. Mary got the shotgun to get his attention.
Get up. Get up, Matthew. I want to talk.
It's possible when Mary was holding the shotgun on Matthew that she did not intend to kill him. Possibly that she was intending to scare him, taking back her own life. It is entirely possible that was her intention. Things didn't work out that way.
She shot Matthew in cold blood while he was sound asleep.
In my opinion, he never got out of bed. She just come in there and cold-blooded murder and shot him.
But that's not the way Mary's defense team sees the shooting.
There were some pillows on the floor where he had kicked her out of the bed earlier that morning. And I believe that she lost her footing.
Get up, Matthew, I want to talk.
Finger was on the trigger and it went off unintentionally.
Did she intentionally shoot him? I don't know, I can't say. I don't believe she did. I believe that our theory was that she either lost her balance standing on some pillows that he had kicked off the floor, or she went into some type of catatonic state and shot him and doesn't remember shooting him.
Investigators later find the telephone disconnected.
The telephone had been unplugged from the wall, in my opinion, to keep him from calling 911.
Taking the shotgun, Mary leaves her husband to die.
Then she took her three little girls, packed them into their car, and hit the road.
For 2 days, America holds its breath, fearing the worst for Mary and her kids. The search for them ends in Orange Beach, Alabama.
There was no one holding Mary. There was no one threatening her girls. It was just Mary and her three little girls at the beach. It was time for Mary to answer for what she'd done.
Just place your left hand on the Bible and raise your right hand.
Put on trial for her husband's murder. It is Mary who will emerge as the victim.
Mary painted a picture of a horribly victimized woman on the witness stand.
Marriage lasted right at 10 years. I believe it was 10 years of hell.
Mary's defense centers on three kinds of abuse she claims to have suffered at the hands of her husband. Emotional, physical, and sexual.
She said that Matthew forced her to commit sexual acts that she didn't want to do. He made her dress up in tardy shoes and wear wigs and wear slutty skirts.
Come on.
He made her do oral sex. He made her do anal sex. And this was outside of prescribed behavior for Christian couples in her mind. That's what Mary claimed in that courtroom.
According to author Diane Fanning, many of Mary's claims lacked proof or substance.
I just didn't buy those arguments. To me, to be sexually abused means that someone has to commit a sexual act on you that you don't want, and you've clearly stated you don't want it. And yet, Mary, after her trial, sat there on the Oprah Winfrey Show and said to that woman, if I ever said no, Matthew stopped right away. In fact, if I ever flinched, Matthew stopped right away.
As proof of physical abuse, Mary points to a black eye she had suffered in previous months.
One time she was playing softball and a ball bounced up and hit her. Well, it hit her in the facial area. She had told us that later on, he had jabbed her in that same area.
Have you seen my Mary's eye? Hopefully she learned to keep her eye on the ball.
Actually, I don't believe very much of anything she said in the trial. I think it was all made up, prefabricated, and the jury bought into it.
The jury's verdict will be one of the most controversial in Tennessee history.
They'd kicked out first-degree murder. They even kicked out second-degree murder. They settled on a manslaughter charge. And then the judge pronounced the verdict. He gave her a 3-year sentence, but he made 2 of it on probation. Then he took away the time she served in jail before she got out on bail. And suddenly Mary had a sentence of 61 days remaining to serve. So Mary, who shot her sleeping husband in the back, would serve 2 months in prison and part of it in a mental health facility and nothing more. Mary got away with murder.
For defense attorneys Leslie Ballin and Steve Farese, the verdict is a triumph of justice.
It was an outstanding outcome. We took a person who had no voice in the system, and we spoke for her. We gave her what I believe was a good defense, an honest defense, a true defense, and we saved her life.
Today, Mary has custody of her 3 children and has begun a new life.
It's a happy family, certainly one without a father in the house, but she is doing great now, just super.
I describe Mary as a cold, calculated murderer. She premeditated Matthew Winkler's murder, and she followed through with it. I'm actually today still concerned for her kids because, you know, if she could do this to her husband, she could do anything.
America remains divided about Mary Winkler. Is she a battered wife who killed by mistake? Or a cold-hearted murderer who remains dangerous? Death can occur in the most ordinary of places. In 1997, a husband's life ended here. His blood flowed down the gutter into the street.
He was just a good guy. He didn't deserve this kind of treatment from anyone. I still find it appalling to think about.
The first shot caused a tremendous amount of pain and panic. He managed to get out of the car. What was going on in his mind? I've got to run away. He may not even have suspected that the shooter was following him. He places the gun square against the back of the skull and pulls the trigger. This would have been the coup de grace.
Tell me, what is it exactly that you do?
Software engineer.
Software engineer? Oh. So, who's having the salad?
I am.
It's a Thank nervous you. First date for computer programmer Bruce Cleland.
No, that's fine.
And the last morning,
thank you.
Oh, wow.
It looks good.
It sure does.
Okay.
This is a meal.
I think some people would call him maybe just a nerdy computer geek.
I'm a software engineer.
He didn't have much in the way of personal contact with women. Didn't date when he was in high school and even in college. So he had almost no contact with women before he met Rebecca.
Really, really, it's a big project. Oh, God, oh. I'm sorry, did I wet you?
No, no,
Bruce's date, Rebecca Salcedo, is his polar opposite.
Bruce is a timid, shy man, But Rebecca was fun, sexy, outrageous, generous, exciting, a terrific person to know. She just attracted men like magnets.
Rebecca finds Bruce just as attractive for a very different reason.
Anyway.
Bruce is the kind of men women like Rebecca look for. He didn't stand a chance.
Bertha Awana used to be Rebecca Salcedo's best friend. She remembers the night she discovered exactly why Rebecca was interested in Bruce.
Thank you. Cheers, girlfriend.
She wanted me to meet the man that she was going to marry. I said, well, where is he? And she's like, oh, no, he's not here. I just want you to meet him through this. So she handed over a paper. And I said, what is this? And she says, this is his credit report. Look at it. And I saw, like, he had all these high credit limits and all these credit cards.
Oh, my God. His wallet is packed with credit cards.
And I just laughed because she was silly that way. So I just took it like, okay, whatever. You know, it's another one of her silly games.
Trading love for money is a game Rebecca's been playing since she was a teenager.
When she was 15, she married a man so she can get him his green card. He was going to pay a lump sum of money. And I was not comfortable with that at all. I just thought it was the wrong thing to do. And that's when I began to see that she was very interested in money.
Coming from a poor family of Mexican immigrants, Rebecca has a dream. A dream of being rich. And she'll use her best assets to get there.
She would like to wear very low-cut dresses. And expose herself whenever she had the opportunity. And she used that to her own advantage in her relationship with men.
When she went to a bar, I don't think she ever bought a drink in her life. She would go to a bar and she would always, all night long, have somebody buying the drinks for her.
Rebecca's latest catch will be picking up a lot more than the bar tab. Her plan is to take him for everything he's got.
Marry me.
And Bruce just walked right into her trap.
I love it.
And he fell for it. Hook, line, and sinker.
But this whirlwind of romance won't have a fairy tale ending.
It just shocked me that she would be capable of such a horrible thing.
She was very outgoing. She had a kind of a bubbly personality. People liked her. She was always the life of the party.
Despite being engaged, Rebecca likes her lovers tall, dark, and often.
She had numerous affairs with various men, including her own cousin, Alvaro, who was in the male stripper.
The only man Rebecca's not sleeping with is her husband-to-be.
Rebecca had told Bruce that she didn't date much, that she had only been with one man, and that she could not have any relationships with a man until she was married. I remember laughing about it, because she would tell me and I would laugh, like, you gotta be kidding.
Truth of the matter was, Rebecca wasn't attracted to Bruce and didn't want to sleep with him, ever.
Crime writer Don Lasseter says Rebecca wasn't in love with Bruce. She was in love with his money.
He began buying her gifts. He bought her a spa for her backyard. He bought a boat with a trailer. Eventually, he even bought her a new SUV, and finally, a beautiful, expensive hilltop home in Whittier, California.
He also paid for her breast augmentation, nose job. She also had her lips done. Rebecca could just get you to do anything. She knew how to charm you.
Rebecca's teenage dreams of riches are coming true. Just weeks after her marriage to Bruce, she takes the final step in her plan.
Bye.
Kicking him out and filing for divorce.
Rebecca wanted a divorce so she could take half of everything Bruce owned.
You said I was going to get half of everything.
But she found out she would earn nothing from that.
And how much is that?
She was only going to get half of anything that was earned during that period of time that they were actually living together, which was maybe about 2 months.
$5,000? Are you kidding me? What am I paying you for?
Prosecutor Ron Bowers believes this is where Rebecca's scheme went from devious to diabolical.
Rebecca, who had had her sights on having a beautiful home, having the new car, having all of the furniture, she was going to lose that all. She was not going to get that in a divorce settlement.
Rebecca refuses to give up on her dream and embarks on a deadly plan B.
In killing Bruce, she would get the life insurance as well as she would get his estate.
It is pitched as a night of reconciliation.
Poor Bruce thinks that she cares and wants to get back together, put the marriage back together.
Listen, we're gonna be there just after 1 o'clock. Don't be late.
The entire time,
and make sure
she's making cell phone calls behind his back.
Okay, I gotta go, he's coming.
And of course, in Bruce's mind, I think, well, maybe we're gonna patch things up. Maybe things are gonna work out.
After a romantic dinner where Bruce is plied with alcohol, Rebecca pulls off the freeway.
She claims that she suddenly notices that there's a red light on the dashboard telling her the back hatch of the SUV is open. Oh, honey, I'll just stop and get out and shut it. And suddenly a man lunges out of the brush and begins shooting at Bruce.
The first shot shatters Bruce's jaw.
The killer follows and continues shooting. The gunman steps up and delivers a deadly shot to the back of Bruce's head. And then runs away. Rebecca is lying behind the SUV as if she had been attacked as well. Her shoes were off in perfect alignment as if they'd been placed in a closet. Police arrived quite quickly, and as soon as they arrived, she got up and said, the carjackers hit me on the head.
What did this to you?
And the police examined her head. No injuries, no injuries at all. She shows no concern for her poor husband lying across the street with blood flowing down the gutter.
Of much greater concern to Rebecca.
They stole my wedding ring.
She claimed, they stole my beautiful ring. They took my ring.
Her prized possession appears to be gone.
I think Rebecca actually thought she was going to pull this off, that she could plan his murder and get away with it. Everything she did was in furtherance of her own greed.
Rebecca's greed will also be her downfall. Wedding photographer Beth Lamb visits Rebecca just days after Bruce's death.
She talked as if she couldn't live without her husband, you know, the love of her life, and she didn't know how she was going to go on.
But Rebecca's sob story is unraveling.
I noticed that she had that huge engagement ring on. And then when I discovered that she was claiming it was stolen, I knew it wasn't. I saw it on her hand. So I was able to let the police know. They were able to get a search warrant and they found it.
Police also find forged life insurance policies. Rebecca stood to gain $1 million from her husband's death. She was also entitled to his entire estate.
Pure evil to marry someone and kill them for their money. You know, that someone could really be that calculating and evil.
Cell phone records reveal the identity of the assassins. Rebecca's cousin Jose and his brother, the stripper, Alvaro.
She really manipulated the two of them to do the dirty work that she wasn't capable of doing herself.
Sentenced to life in prison, Rebecca's dreams of riches lie shattered. Her lifelong friendships destroyed.
I never thought I would personally know someone that would be able to commit such a heinous crime. It still haunts me. Sometimes I dream about her and I just want to forget about her. It's just something that I want to erase out of my life.
Be careful who you fight with. Be careful who you mock and who you try to destroy. Because it might just come back to visit you, and it did them.
What pushed this scorned ex-wife to breaking point and beyond? Author Greg Olson has written about dozens of killers. The tale of Betty Broderick captivated him like no other.
What got all of us, and I mean all of Americans really interested in this case, was the idea of this attractive woman who was on the top of the world at one moment, and then when her husband dumped her, she became this caricature of evil and despair. And we all wondered how it got that way.
In the early years of Betty's marriage, there is little to hint at the calamity to come.
Hi, baby.
She was the kind of girl, like probably everybody of her age, who dreamed of being a good wife and mother. That's really all she wanted out of life. She would like to find the right man, and she thought she did when she found Dan Broderick.
How do I look?
Like $1 million.
Yeah.
Good luck. Handsome Dan already has a medical degree from Cornell. Now his wife Betty juggles motherhood and part-time work to put him through Harvard Law School.
Can we keep the toys in the basket?
Sorry.
She looked at her job to be the background for Dan. She was the one that worked. She put him through school. So that's what she viewed her job to do, is to make it so he could be successful.
Betty sacrificed a lot supporting Dan, and she just kept waiting for that day, that great day, when all the hard work would be over and they could relax and coast.
10 years later, Betty's hard work has paid off for her husband. While Dan's a high-flying San Diego lawyer, his success hasn't brought happiness to Betty.
Dan was talking to Betty about how she didn't look good anymore. She was losing her looks. He was not coming home. She knew something was going on. He was accusing her of being crazy and of imagining things that weren't there.
Betty is not imagining things.
I think she always knew that he was a player, and she had seen signs of it over the years in their marriage.
Behind her back, Dan has started an affair with his 21-year-old secretary, Linda Kolkina.
You're not
betrayal.
Not working for clients. I am your wife.
You want the truth?
Yes, I do.
You're old and fat.
I think she knew that it was over. And she became completely unhinged. There's no question about that.
She put all of his clothes, and he was a dandy. That was his most important possession. She put it on the barbecue, lit the barbecue, burned him up.
Like half of American marriages, this one is headed for divorce. But what will make it end in murder?
It was a collision course. She was going to be dead, or they were.
California, 1985. Betty Broderick's 16-year marriage is history. Her millionaire husband has traded her in for a younger version.
I think that's the thing that hurt her the most, or the hardest to deal with, is just looking and realizing, okay, she's just being replaced.
Defense attorney Jack Early believes when Betty's marriage ended, her world collapsed.
Her dream was to set up the perfect marriage, to have memories, the photos, the grandchildren. That was Betty's dream, and that was what was taken away from her.
This is only the beginning of Betty's torment.
I was provoked, Your Honor.
In the divorce court, everything that matters to her will be chipped away.
He made over $1 million a year as a malpractice attorney, so he was doing great. And she came away with, I think, a little under $30,000 for 20 years of marriage, and a marriage that was built on her hard work, too.
Kindly refrain from using that.
And Dan will take something even more precious, something crucial to Betty's identity.
I'd like to move that her visitation rights be withheld until she seeks psychiatric treatment.
They batted around custody for quite a while. In the end, Dan did get custody, and I don't know that he really wanted the kids, but he didn't want Betty to have them, and that was part of the game.
Very well. Custody of the children is granted to Mr. Dan Broderick. Case dismissed.
Betty felt that her role was the mother. She wanted to be with those kids. And Dan, to stop Betty from having the kids seemed to be his goal.
Divorce leaves Betty broke and alone. Now Linda rubs salt into her wounds.
The woman who replaced Betty in her husband's bed, Linda, taunted Betty beyond comprehension, sending her wrinkle cream ads and weight loss material. That was actually turning the knife after it had been plunged into her heart.
5 years after the divorce, another letter arrives. It's the final straw. Betty thinks she'll regain custody of her kids.
She received a letter from Dan. She thought she was going to get her children back.
Like all Betty's other dreams, this one is dashed.
The letter basically was telling her that they were always going to be having her in a vice grip, and she was not going to be able to have a normal life for her with her children back.
No!
That letter, sitting reading it at 3 o'clock in the morning, is, I think, the thing, the drop of water that finally just broke the dam.
No!
Betty lost everything. She lost a beautiful home. She lost a loving family. She lost her position in society. But more than anything, she really lost who she was, what herself was, and I think that killed her.
Betty feels there's only one way out. She enters her ex-husband's house to make a dramatic statement.
She had this idea that she was going to go kill herself in front of her husband, saying, "You've taken everything from me. You've taken my home. You've taken my children. You've taken whoever I was, and I'm going to pay you back big time by killing myself." Right there, and you're going to see it.
In the final moment, Betty's self-pity is overtaken by another emotion. Revenge.
I do not believe she was there to shoot them. But that's what she did.
Linda is killed instantly. Her husband of 6 months, Dan, survives for half an hour before choking on his own blood.
Betty was driven to murder because of uncontrollable rage brought on by being discarded and treated like garbage by the man she loved. She was destroying the people who had destroyed her. It was the only way to end her pain.
Within hours of committing the double murder, Betty surrenders to police.
She was tried twice. The first was a hung jury. Four people on that jury said, "There's just no way she should be guilty of that crime, that Dan and Linda caused it to happen by pushing those buttons." And then in the second trial, she was convicted of second-degree murder and sentenced to prison.
And the judge gave her a sentence of 32 to life, which in effect, under the law at that time, made her eligible for parole for the first time in the year 2010.
Because Betty Broderick refuses to show remorse for her crimes, that parole is denied.
I do feel a kind of a unique sympathy for the killer. And I don't usually feel that way about people. I feel that people should pay for their crimes, go away to prison, and we should forget about them. But I think of her, and I think about what has been taken from her and how she reacted, and I think it's cautionary. We all better be careful that, you know, partners in this life that we try to create are equal and valuable. And she wasn't. She was treated like she was nothing.
These deadly women signed their wedding vows in blood. Mary Winkler turned from preacher's wife to lethal widow. Rebecca Salcedo was consumed by passion for a man's money. And Betty Broderick destroyed those who had destroyed her. These dangerous wives were joined in unholy matrimony, united by a prophetic oath, "Till death do us part."